Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, broadcasters say TV leaders' debates before the general election will go ahead even if any party refuses to take part. The four channels have put forward new proposals which involve one head-to-head between David Cameron and Ed Miliband. There will also be two seven-way debates, including the SNP, Plaid Cymru and the Greens. But DUP leader Peter Robinson says if parties in Scotland and Wales are involved, those in Northern Ireland should be too.
These are broadcasters who bring on people most of the time to tell the political parties how they're not doing a good job and how they should be running the country, and they can't even run a debate themselves.
Syria-related terror arrests increased sixfold last year. Scotland Yard says a total of 165 people were detained across the country in 2014, compared to just 25 the year before. A&E waiting times in England have improved for a second successive week, but hospitals are still missing national targets. NHS England wants 95% of patients seen within 4 hours, but it's now 3 months since that figure was reached. This week's results will be released next Friday. Nick Holm, who runs Ipswich Hospital in Suffolk, isn't confident there'll be an improvement.
What we've seen that's been different from previous years is that in the past we've seen lots of patients who perhaps could have gone to their GP, who could have used primary care. We're seeing less of those patients this year. What we are seeing are much sicker patients who need to be admitted.
A ceremony for Saudi Arabia's new king has been taking place following his predecessor's death. King Salman succeeds his half-brother King Abdullah, who's died aged 90. Prince Charles and David Cameron are travelling to Saudi Arabia to pay their condolences. Unions say a strike by NHS workers could still go ahead next week despite 3 days of talks with health officials. Staff in England and Northern Ireland are due to walk out on Thursday in a row over pay. And Coronation Street actress Barbara Knox has been banned from driving for a year after admitting drink driving. She was caught as she drove to a police station to see her daughter, who'd been stopped earlier for the same offence. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
On BCFM, independent, international, just interesting and innovative tunes, as well as reviews, chat and regular What Songs.
Not all of us hate you.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jimmy Savile syndrome strikes again. Another establishment suspect takes his secrets to his grave, this time former Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton. We ask why the police and Crown Prosecution Service failed to act on allegations about Leon Britton, and ask, is Theresa May's stillborn inquiry, which was supposed to start last July, ever going to get off the ground? Never let it be said that one honest person can't change things. The US lawyer who single-handedly overturned the acres of lies and myths about the underpants bomber. We hear from Kurt Haskell, who was on the flight and blew the FBI and security services plot wide open. But we start this week from Canada. The 9/11 consensus panel is planning to force a debate in the Canadian Parliament about what really happened in New York and Washington on September the 11th, 2001. And I'm joined from Canada on the line now by Elizabeth Woodward, who's one of the members of the 9/11 consensus panel. Hi, Elizabeth, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Nice to be on. Thank you.
First of all, can you just explain to us, what is this 9/11 consensus panel and how did it start?
The 9/11 consensus panel was co-founded by Dr. David Ray Griffin and myself in 2011 after we had been working on 7 or 8 of his books. You may know, your listeners may know that Dr. David Ray Griffin is probably the top scholar in the 9/11 community, looking into all the things that we haven't been told by the media. And his 8 books. He's been nominated 3 times for the Nobel Peace Prize in Europe for the work, the outstanding scholarly work he's done in the area.
Can you just give us an idea of maybe one or two of the books he's written and what their titles are then?
Well, he wrote the, first of all, he wrote The New Pearl Harbor. That book really sold a lot of copies. It was a very simple little book that laid out the evidence on both sides of whether there were a lot of coincidences that day or whether there was complicity.
Okay, so can you just explain to us what is the comparison between 9/11 and Pearl Harbor? That's a bit of a mystifying one to me.
The New Pearl Harbor? Oh, that's based on the title. The title's based on the Pearl Harbor event during World War II, when Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, and that was allowed to happen. It's pretty well understood in the scholarly world that was allowed to happen, and so the New Pearl Harbor was 9/11 being allowed to happen.
Okay, so the idea back in World War II was that because it was, even though some of the people on the inside knew it was going to happen, they did nothing about it because they knew this was going to have a big shock effect on the population.
That's right, and that it would bring America into the war, and that was, they needed a strong public consensus that now's the time, we've got to do something. So that was the intent behind 9/11, was to galvanize a public response that would allow the United States to go into the Middle East to prevent further attacks on its own soil.
Okay, so you've come up with 44 consensus points, haven't you?
That's right.
Quite a lot, and I don't think we've got time to go through them all. But do you want to just cherry-pick some of these particular points which you think are so important that people understand about what happened on 9/11?
One really strong point is that in the United States every year there are Air Force drills, really big ones involving the whole U.S. Air Force. And they're annual drills, and they generally happen in April or October, April and October, and other months. Well, it turned out that all these annual drills were actually happening the morning of September 11th, and they were rescheduled. All our consensus points, which are at on the web, they're at consensus911.org. You can see them all there. And we actually found a news item in the military news, they have their internal newspapers, saying that this one big drill, I think it was Global Guardian, which normally happens in October or September, actually late October, it was scheduled for the morning of 9/11. So there was so much confusion that morning that it provided a cover for the military to say, well, we really couldn't take effective action that morning because there was all this going on too.
No, well, I remember playing a clip years ago, Elizabeth, where they had actually somebody in one of the control rooms, NORAD, saying, "Is this a real world or is this an exercise?"
Exactly, and that's I believe we quoted that line in that consensus point. World Trade Center 7, this is a building that's considered to be the Achilles heel of the 9/11 official account, because a 47-story steel frame building the size of a football field, it's just an enormous building, it would be bigger than any building in most cities in Canada, and that building fell down into its own footprint at 5:20 p.m. on the afternoon of September 11th. It just felt in 6.25 seconds. There was no resistance at all. If you dropped a bowling ball off the top of the roof, it would have hit the ground same time as the building fell. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology was given the job of explaining how this happened, because it was not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report, which was the official report on 9/11 that was published in 2004. Never mentioned that building. So NIST, to get around, to be able to explain this phenomenon, They said that no steel, they couldn't examine the steel because none was recovered from World Trade Center 7. So, which is extraordinary because it was such a big building. But recently, under Freedom of Information requests, we have obtained a photograph of the head NIST investigator standing beside the steel. And it shows he's pointing to a piece of steel, the end of which is completely melted. So, you know, this was not a collapse from office fires.
Well, that's interesting. But the thing is, the trouble is, after a building has collapsed like that, you're not necessarily thinking about doing a forensic collection of all the evidence. You're thinking, well, here's a load of scrap metal. Let's sell it off.
Well, that's what they said. But in fact, it was a crime scene. It's the biggest crime scene the United States has ever witnessed. To have planes hitting buildings, and especially buildings that the architect who designed them, he said, these buildings are constructed like a big, like a screen door that you have in your house. It's like a mesh, and if something hit it hard, like a bullet, say, or a pencil poked through, the rest of the mesh would remain intact. It would have its integrity, its structural integrity. And he said these buildings were actually designed to have planes hit them. Same size plane as did hit them, and it should have just created a local damage to the building, but not a complete structural collapse.
Well, we've dealt with the non-appearance of the U.S. Air Force shooting down planes, which is what it's supposed to do if they're heading for some kind of... I mean, for example, if you were to hijack a plane and head it towards a nuclear power station or the Pentagon, the U.S. Air Force is authorized, or whichever Air Force, to shoot it down. And that previous claim about Building 7. But one of the things that really fascinates me is, I know at the time of 9/11 itself, in the day or so after, there were a lot of claims about insider trading, saying, well, there was some very suspicious trades going on, something called put options, which is where you bet that a certain company's share price is going to go down. And in this case, it was United Airlines and American Airlines. So, and I know you've discovered a bit about that also, Elizabeth, about what really happened, because that story was there in the news the day after, I suppose it's whatever, September the 12th, but then it completely disappeared.
Oh, the story disappeared, yes. And we do have a consensus point on exactly that matter, written by an economist who was a member of the consensus panel for a little while. And it's on our consensus website at consensus911.org. And there are quite a number of current economists who are still writing about this, and the evidence they're giving, one of them is in Switzerland, is saying this... a thorough economic analysis shows that this was a most unlikely event, that these, you know, they feel that there was some kind of skullduggery going on, and that people knew in advance that the attacks were going to happen.
So old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me in the studio here. I know has done a little bit of digging around that himself, because one of the reasons that the story died was because the actual end of the story, in other words, who was behind these put options, was rather an unpalatable result, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Rupert, the former Los Angeles police officer who sadly died recently, he's done a lot of work on this, and he pointed the finger firmly at Buzzy Krongard, who was a former executive director of the CIA at Deutsche Bank, who then moved to Deutsche Bank. But, I mean, the point about this is we're not investigators, Elizabeth, are we? We're just pointing out the holes in the official story. It's for the police and others ought to pick this up and investigate it properly. We're just pointing out this can't be right.
Yes, the function of the consensus panel is to provide all the evidence that will be used in court whenever 9/11 finally gets thoroughly, officially investigated. Like, we've done all their homework, basically.
Well, hang on a minute, because there's already been a 9/11 commission, Elizabeth.
That's right, and Dr. Griffin, that was his second book. It was called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And he found, I believe, 115 omissions and distortions in that report. And it's interesting because right now the executive director of the 9/11 Commission report is a man called Philip Zelikow. And you may have heard that right now the earlier report, which was carried out in 2002, that was an intelligence report about the why did intelligence fail? And that was a long, long report, a bipartisan joint report of the Senate and the Congress, 858 pages long, and 28 of those pages were never released to the public. And those pages cover who financed 9/11. Now, Mr. Zelikow came along 2 years later, and he wouldn't let his staff see the pages. He could see them, but nobody was allowed to see them. And now there's a call to see these 28 pages, because there are 23 congressmen and women right now who are saying, we finally have to know who financed the 9/11 attacks. And the government's holding this information close to its chest. It won't declassify them. And Mr. Zelikow has come out like 10 years later. He's still trying to protect the pages. And so everybody's wondering, why do they need to be classified? Why can't the American public know who financed 9/11? So this is a big thing that's going on right now, and you can watch for it. It's been covered in the mainstream media. I don't know if it was covered in Britain, but it's been covered by CNN and ABC and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Everybody's looking at this right now.
Now, another one of your consensus points, or at least areas of them, Elizabeth, is the political and military command on 9/11. I mean, I know you looked at the exercises that were going on, because, I mean, surely that's quite an important thing that we need to forget for a minute about national security, and we need to know what went wrong on 9/11, don't we?
Yes. It's very interesting, and it is original research that the panel has done into what six of the top military and political command were doing that morning. And we can trace their actions through the 9/11 Commission report records, which are all now public in the National Archives. And we have found that, contrary to what the Commission report claimed, that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, General Myers, General Hugh Shelton, Brigadier General Montague Winfield, and others were not at their stations that morning as they should have been. They couldn't be reached. There's so much lying about where they were and why they couldn't be reached over a period that went from, you know, when the first plane went off course at 8-something until after the last plane crashed at 10:07. These men just couldn't be found. And so it turned out they could be found, and that they were there, you know, at their stations and calling the shots, but either purposefully or by incompetence or failing to stop anything from happening.
Well, the other thing, of course, is, Elizabeth, I have to ask, is why is this important? I mean, this is all a long, long time ago. A lot of research and a lot of film has been, and documentaries made about the September the 11th attacks. Why is it still important, do you think?
Oh, because it's the mother episode of it's kind of the touchstone for saying that there's a global war on terror. That's where it started with 9/11, this idea that terrorists are lurking everywhere in the world waiting to attack the United States again, and so we have to go in and preemptively stop them. And I say we because Canada is very close to the United States. And so this gives, and everybody nods their heads, the citizens say, well, this is fine, like, this is understandable, we were attacked. And so whenever these so-called terrorists emerge, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, wherever it may, or say in France, in Paris, at the Boston Marathon, it's always Muslims. And they're always known to the FBI in advance. And the whole thing goes back to 9/11. So if the mother false flag attack can be exposed, then it throws into doubt the whole story about how the West needs to go into the Middle East and stop future attacks.
Also, I know that you're trying to get a debate going in the Canadian government. How are you proposing to do that, Elizabeth?
Well, we're halfway into it already. It's not just the consensus panel, Tony. The Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is about 2,300 architects and engineers in an organization run by Richard Gage. That there's three organizations. There's that one, the Architects and Engineers. There's a very good little group in Canada called Rethink911.ca, and then there's the Consensus Panel. And these three organizations are pressing. We submitted a Rethink 911 submitted a petition to Parliament on December 3rd, and it was presented, tabled in Parliament, asking for a parliamentary review of 9/11, of the 9/11 Commission report findings, because they're so tenuous and unsupportable. And so once a petition, this probably works in your House of Commons too, once a petition is on the floor of the House, it has to be answered, it has to be addressed as a democratic action. So it's been there, and they're going to reconvene. They've been off on recess over the month of January and Christmas. They're coming back next week, and right now there are quite a number of... we've sent out letters to a lot of people in Canada who are interested in this, in the problem of 9/11, and they're writing to their members of Parliament in the last few days, so that when Parliament gets back, the members of Parliament will be educated about why this was done. So this is an interesting thing, and it's kind of newsworthy. It was covered on our global TV national network, and this is what we're hoping, that Parliament will have a good look and start asking questions about why Canada has been involved sending troops, having its military men lose their lives over in the Middle East after 9/11.
I just wonder, because, I mean, why is the relevance for that today? I mean, surely this is just a bit more bureaucracy for the Canadian Parliament.
Why is it relevant today?
Yeah.
Did you say? Well, because it's 9/11 is still the prime kind of trigger for all imperialistic moves that have been made by the United States into the Middle East. And it's still being used, like the global war on terror is still the rationale for all that. The news headlines, you know, they're almost every day, and these headlines are actually they're on the front burner, they're taking the place of what should be on the front burner, which is global warming.
Well, I noticed that also Canadian troops are actually over in Iraq at the moment, even though there was a speech at Davos by the Iraqi vice president yesterday saying he wants all foreign troops out of Iraq. They're in there, and they're actually been killing ISIS militants.
Yes, and ISIS certainly emerged very quickly onto the scene. You know, a lot of us think that it instead of kind of gradually working itself up into a threatening force, It appeared rather quickly, and I believe that there's quite a lot of evidence that ISIS has been Saudi Arabia and possibly the United States CIA have been financing ISIS to create the kind of turmoil over there that is then required to be fixed by us.
Okay, well, look, finally, Elizabeth, can you recommend maybe one or two books or films for us and our listeners so we can get up to speed on what really happened on 9/11?
I think one of the very best things is the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, 1 hour video called Experts Speak Out, and that's on YouTube. It just takes an hour, and there are several dozen, I think, engineers and architects, really calm and credible people speaking about the way the towers fell. And once people see that, that actually rose to number one a couple of years ago on PBS, Public Broadcasting's PBS system, I guess it is. It's the alternative, the main alternative network in the U.S. It was number one for several weeks, I think. So people really found that to be a useful hour.
Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us, Elizabeth Woodward from Canada. Whereabouts are you in Canada, Elizabeth?
In Victoria.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show tonight. Just a reminder, your website is www.consensus911.org.
That's it.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's have a little chat with you about this, because we kind of left it there with Elizabeth on what's happening now. ISIS, she was saying, I've certainly seen some evidence that the Saudi citizens are funding ISIS and that they may have been trained by NATO intelligence, people like special forces from the NATO countries.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. If you remember two years ago, the way the Western media pack works is really extraordinary. 2 years ago, we were being told that Assad was a brutal dictator, he had to go, and that there was going to be democracy all over the Middle East, the Muslim Brotherhood had just won an election in Egypt, Assad was the next domino to fall, and we were helping the brave people of Syria to take up weaponry and defend themselves against an evil government, blah, blah, blah. And that was the line. And these people were freedom fighters, and there was definitely evidence, it was in most media around the world, that special forces from Britain, from France, from the US, were in Jordan, were in Turkey, training the relevant militants to carry through
the
revolution.
I remember reading that first in the Sunday Express gosh, this is interesting.
Indeed, and of course, if we don't talk much about Libya now, because that's kind of gone down the plug hole, but of course, we were very much working with the militant groups in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi, particularly the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. The Libyan chapter of Al-Qaeda has intimate links with Western intelligence services going back years and years and years and years.
But what's all
they were
this?
using them as a means of leverage on Gaddafi.
But what's all this got to do with 9/11?
Well, what it's got to do with 9/11 is 9/11, as Elizabeth pointed out, is the mother false flag terrorist attack, the biggest one, the one that woke the most people up around the world, shocked the most people, had the most impact. But of course, as I was saying on Russian TV yesterday, in Turkey, people have had all of this done to them through their Ergonikon networks. There's overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services are involved in terrorism in Western Europe. All of this within living memory. Nobody's been punished. This is the Gladio networks and so on. And I think people really need to get an understanding of the vicious modus operandi of the gangster ruling class that we've now developed in the Western world. And they're going to need to wise up pretty quick, because they are dragging us to a world war with Russia, China and Iran in order to achieve their nefarious goals.
But, I mean, you talk about a gangster ruling class. I mean, I might say, for example, criminal elite. But at the end of the day, Martin, at the end of the day, we've got the media and we've got the courts to deal with these people.
Well, the media is us and the courts don't want to know, but that doesn't mean that we should give up the fight. That's obviously not the point. We've got to try and find a way to open the questions up, and ultimately, of course, we need police investigations of all this bad behaviour. And of course, there is a model here in Italy in the 1990s and thereafter. The courts and the magistrates did start to investigate what NATO intelligence services were up to, and as I've mentioned on this show before, Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book which came out at the end of 2012 called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who'd been involved in most of these investigations, assassination of Aldo Moro, Bologna bombing, pointed the finger very firmly at NATO security services for being behind that terrorism. Now, in other words, in Western Europe, since 1945, NATO intelligence services have killed far more people and innocent people than all of the terrorist groups that were supposedly illegal, like ETA and Provisional IRA, managed to kill. But most people are blissfully unaware of this, because the mainstream media, things like Radio 4 or whatever, you could go to a Radio 4 presenter and say, do you know that NATO is a known terrorist infrastructure, and they will poo-poo it. Because in actual fact, it's open there, it's in plain sight. And I think we've reached the point now where we've got to be absolutely straight with people. The people running the show are criminals, they're well armed, they're very dangerous. If, for example, they were behind the Paris attacks, that's a whole lot of innocent people who've been mashed up through what they're doing. But they are defeatable, they are vulnerable, and the truth will ultimately get them.
Now, you're implying there, in fact, no, you're saying, you're stating that it, when a bang goes off in Europe somewhere, a bomb somewhere in Italy, wherever, that actually it's NATO that put it there in many cases. Can you, have you got any evidence for that?
We've got lots of evidence for them doing it in the past. When a bomb goes off tomorrow, we will not have that evidence. We will have to look into it as we have to look at every incident as it occurs. But there is no doubt, there's a body of evidence. People, all they need to do is do a basic internet search on Gladio, which was the name, the code name of these infrastructures, and Ergonikon in Turkey was a branch of Gladio. And this is police investigations in Italy which have drawn all this to the light.
I think Gladio might be easier to spell than Ergonikon.
Yes, indeed.
So you've seen this thing in the past. What about this latest attack in Paris? Any evidence there?
We've covered this in previous weeks, Tony. One of the obvious things that people picked up on is that these very, very experienced, obviously militarily trained hit squad, covered with balaclavas, didn't want to give their identities away, managed to leave their identity card in the getaway car, which then allowed the government to say, oh, we know who did this immediately, and then, of course, all the so-called culprits are now dead, so we're never going to find out who did really carry out the attack. And, of course, the president of Turkey has pointed out that there are problems with the story, and he's questioned whether it's been carried out from the inside. That's the president of Turkey. And, of course, president of Turkey, Erdogan, he knows, and people in Turkey know very well, NATO does carry out attacks. They carried out lots of attacks in the 80s and 90s in Turkey, and everybody in Turkey knows this. People who listen to Radio 4 don't know this. People in Turkey do. People who live in Italy know that these things happen. But what happens is the mainstream media basically gives people a lot of candy floss about the way the world actually works. But if you don't have to go far to talk to people who do know what happens. Erdogan questioned the Charlie Hebdo attack. So did Jean-Marie Le Pen of the French National Front, for example. He picked up on the passport, on the document. And he said, well, that was very similar to Mohammed Atta's passport being found on the smoking ruins of the World Trade Center. Not believable.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Jimmy Savile syndrome strikes again, does it? Another establishment suspect takes his secrets to the grave. This time it's Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton. And I'm joined on the line now by documentary maker, ex-Yorkshire Television, now making films for places like Al Jazeera, Tim Tate. Hi, Tim, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello.
Now, what's your thoughts about this news this week about the death of Leon Britton? Because many people are saying, are frustrated really, that there doesn't seem to be much advancing of the national inquiry. And his name has come up several times as someone that may well have been talked about if that inquiry had been allowed to proceed.
I think that the key evidence, insofar as it exists, about Britton is currently residing in an office of the Metropolitan Police in London. And the reason I say that is that in spring last year, I sat down with a very senior Metropolitan Police Service detective who was involved in investigating historic child sexual abuse. And he had a reasonable amount of information, including a particular statement, which I guess we'll come to, about Britton. And in the case of that statement, about Britain's alleged attempt to import child pornography to the UK.
Now, that's a pretty strong accusation. But at what time was this? Was it maybe before he was an MP or something?
No, this was in the mid-80s. For absolute clarity, what we should recognise is that I have no independent means of verifying what this detective told me. But what he told me was that the detective had interviewed, or his colleagues had interviewed, a former customs officer, a man who has been publicly named. His name is Maganal Solanki. And Mr. Solanki had, in and amongst other things, told the officers from the Metropolitan Police that at some point in the mid-1980s, Mr. Solanki, had stopped Leon Britton coming through customs at Dover, had been suspicious and had searched his car and had found child pornography videotapes. He knew they were child pornography because, according to Mr. Solanki, he viewed them and he was able to describe what was on them. And the detective told me that he questioned Mr. Solanki and said, well, how do you know it was beyond Britain? And Mr. Solanke apparently said, well, I asked to see his passport. And further, that the Mr. Britton had told him, Mr. Solanke, that he was an MP, an MEP. Now, the detective suspected that was either a mishearing or a misunderstanding, because certainly at the probable time we're talking about, Leon Britton was no longer in Parliament. He was, in fact, a European politician. There is a statement to that effect from Mr. Solanke inside the offices of the Metropolitan Police. It has not, to the best of my knowledge, had any further action taken on it. I feel, and I think other people feel, that it's one of the documents, and Mr. Solanke and this detective are two of the people who need to be called and brought before both the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is investigating historic child abuse and in its relationship to the government, and to the official historic child abuse inquiry, assuming that continues.
I think the question in many people's minds, Tim, is what's in the way? Because there seems to be quite a lot of these allegations. Obviously, we've got an election coming up. That's a very big incentive on the Conservative Party to delay the child sexual abuse inquiry that Theresa May set up. But the police surely can investigate these things. They can take the evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service. However rich and powerful somebody is, surely they should just simply end up in court like anyone else would.
You'd think, wouldn't you? To answer your second question first, what the detective told me was that he was... they were also investigating allegations, what they believed to be credible evidence, that Mr. Britton had abused a boy, a young boy, at the now infamous Elm Guest House in southwest London during the early 1980s. And at the point when I had this lengthy meeting with the detective, they were pursuing that, though there were problems with the evidence, but the detective believed that to be credible. He was facing a number of problems at that point. One of the problems was some truly irresponsible, inaccurate and inflammatory reporting by tabloids and indeed a particular news website, which had managed to muddy the waters and print utterly false allegations, which were causing immense problems to the police, political problems. And I think you have to be realistic and say that this is a political with a small p issue. That was one of his problems. Another of his problems was that at that point, the historic child abuse operation was grossly underfunded and understaffed, and they just didn't have enough people to deal with it. Now, that the staff has apparently been increased, but finally, the detective concerned was expecting to be moved away from the inquiry. And he was less than convinced that the inquiries into Britton, and indeed other people, would be as vigorously pursued once he was moved.
Okay, what about other countries? And do you think this is something very particularly specialist to Britain? Because one of the arguments I've heard, and I actually think is that there may be some case there, is that actually the British are doing something rather good here, and this sort of thing would happen in other countries and not be investigated. Actually, here in Britain, there is actually an attempt to get to the bottom of it.
Well, yes and no. I think the idea of a historic child sexual abuse inquiry is absolutely terrific, and it's something I've been arguing and campaigning for 25 plus years. And I was involved in the lobbying effort last summer, which actually finally pushed, I think, Theresa May over the edge and said, all right, we'll hold this thing. My efforts were a very small part of a much wider movement to get this in place, and I think it's a very good thing. There are two problems with that, though. Firstly, it has been calamitously run. The first issue, the first problem it faced, as your listeners probably know, is that it appointed Dame Butler Sloss to be the inquiry chair. Her brother was the Attorney General at the time when the paedophile information exchange had infiltrated government and indeed had advised against prosecuting the paedophile information exchange. She was plainly untenable, and they should have known that from the start. The Home Office then took an awful long time to come up with a replacement. That replacement was a woman called Fiona Wolfe, who had no experience of child sexual abuse inquiries, but did happen to be a personal friend or acquaintance of Leon Britton. And that then fell over, and she had to resign in some ignominy. There is now no chair. The inquiry members are, to some extent, fighting amongst themselves. They have no guidance. Theresa May has herself said that she may have to stand it down and create a new one after the election on a statutory basis. It is, frankly, in chaos. And whilst the idea is great, and it's long, long overdue, the performance of the Home Office in setting this up has been farcical. And to answer your second point is, well, other countries might say, well, we should be doing exactly what Britain is doing, and I think that's absolutely true. The caveat to that is that compared to, for example, the United States, we actually devote very little law enforcement effort to proactive policing of paedophile networks. The US spends an awful lot of time, money and effort doing this, and is very, very good at it. The UK doesn't, really. If it does it, it polices it reactively, so only when someone makes a complaint, and doesn't bother to investigate or collect proper intelligence in the way that it needs to.
I know you've got a lot of experience, written books on the subject, Tim. Have you got any kind of tips for those involved in the inquiry, pushing for the inquiry, to get this moving? Because it does look as if this is going to be such a big embarrassment, possibly in the run-up to the May general election, that the Home Office really is trying to make sure that it doesn't even get going until after then.
I think the key to this is this body, the Home Affairs Select Committee. And again, I don't know what your listeners know, but this is a parliamentary committee. It's an all-party committee. Its chair is a Labour member of parliament called Keith Vaz, and it has been really quite good in hauling the Home Office over the coals and making it do what it should do. And what I and others have been asking for the last 12 hours or so since news of Leon Britton's death emerged is that people write to Keith Vaz as chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee and ask him to summon before it, and Parliament has the powers to do this, both the customs officer who claims to have stopped Leon Britton in possession of child pornography, the detective whose name Mr. Vaz and indeed others know, who spoke to me, who is able and willing, I would imagine, to give the evidence, provided he's protected, and to access the documents on Keith, on Leon Britton, which are sitting in the home, in the Metropolitan Police Historic Abuse Inquiry files. And the reason this needs to happen is that Leon Britton wasn't just any politician. He was Home Secretary at one point. He was Home Secretary at the time when the now infamous Jeffrey Dickens dossier on the paedophile information exchange and influential paedophiles was handed to him and then went missing.
Okay, Tim Tate, documentary maker from Wiltshire, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thanks very much.
Made in Bristol, this is BCFM 93.2.
pretty shocking stuff, Martin, about Leon Britton there. And one wonders, doesn't one, whether the police are going to get charges, trials, this sort of thing going, and whether the Crown Prosecution are also going to get into line and treat some of the people with allegations in powerful positions. Because, as I said right at the top of the hour, this is Jimmy Savile syndrome. People are dying who are being accused and not actually coming to court.
Well, presumably the perpetrators, whoever they may be, are hopeful that that's exactly what will happen and that they will be able to live out their lives without being dragged through the courts as people like Jimmy Savile weren't, but Rolf Harris was. I think the underlying thing about
I think, in a way, I'm just a little bit unhappy about the comparison between the two, because I think that what's happened is, since, with people like Dave Lee Travis, etc., is that there's been a completely different level of sexual abuse which has been kind of presented to the public since the Savile affair as, oh, we're doing something about this. But actually, these are very minor offences compared to the sort of things that Leon Britton's being accused of, and also Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget that this investigation has now turned to murder. We're not just talking about child sex abuse, we're talking about child murder. Now, I think the real iceberg under the waves here is the use of child sex abuse as a tool by powerful groups connected to the intelligence services, for example. So I keep mentioning the Kincorra Boys Home in Northern Ireland. It's a big issue in Northern Ireland. Everybody talks about it. It's not the sort of thing that's swept under the carpet.
Yeah, so what was MI5's involvement in that?
Well, they were the allegation is that they were using the Kincorra Boys Home as a honey trap. In other words, they were inviting politicians or paramilitary leaders, it was the original allegation, in there to have sex with underage boys, but then they were being filmed, and then, of course, they were saying, right, now, whoever you from the UDA, UVF, whoever you are, you've now been filmed having sex with underage boys, and now you're in our grasp. But recent stuff I've read about Kincorra suggests that top politicians from the other side of the water were going over there and having sex with underage boys, and it looks as if these other homes, like the Elmbridge Guest House and so on, now this
so we've got Dolphin Square and Elmbridge Guest House.
So in other words, what this looks like is a series of safe locations where this could carry on. Now, and of course, the purpose of this, from the point of view of manipulation, is child sex abuse is rightly regarded as a heinous crime. It's the sort of thing that you're never going to live down. Having a gay affair is no longer going to end your political career in Britain, but it wouldn't just end your political career, it'll end your social life completely if you were ever convicted. So it's very, very powerful as a means of controlling people who can, and powerful people are drawn into these groups quite deliberately in order to compromise
it. So, but instead of actually being summoned to court, going to trial for any connection possibly within this whole evidence being tested over Kincorra Boys scale, MI5 have been invited onto Blue Peter.
Well, indeed. And of course, people need to realise that when they see a James Bond film, that is fiction. The reality, as we've been saying earlier in this hour, is that NATO intelligence services, definitely including MI6, use paedophilia, use blackmail, and also organise terrorist attacks. They do.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Now, never let it be said that one honest person can't change things. A US lawyer who single-handedly overturned the acres of lies and myths about the underpants bomber. We hear from Kurt Haskell now, who was on the flight and blew the FBI security service plot wide open. And he's a US lawyer now living in Costa Rica.
Back on Christmas Day 2009, my wife and I were coming back from a safari in Africa. We had a connecting flight through Amsterdam back to Detroit, where we lived at the time. And we were sitting near the gate waiting for our flight, playing cards, and I saw what looked like a wealthy Indian-type looking man escorting what looked like a poor African teenager, late teenager approximately, up to the counter, and they talked to the girl at the counter, and only the wealthy Indian man spoke, and he said, "This man needs to get on the plane, but he doesn't have a passport." And the girl at the counter said, "Well, no passport, you can't get on the plane." To which the wealthy Indian man argued with her, saying, he's from Sudan, and we do this all the time, something along those lines. And she said, well, then you'll have to go down the hallway and talk to a manager. And that was in a secure area, but the wealthy Indian man escorted him down the hallway without an escort. And I quit watching at this point, not thinking anything of it. Little did I know that approximately 8 hours later, as our flight was doing our descent into Detroit, that this African kid that I saw here would try and detonate a bomb, or at least at that time I thought it was a bomb, as we're coming into land in Detroit, and subsequently he became known as the underwear bomber. Well, I tried to tell what I saw to the FBI upon landing, and I did, and they're initially really interested. You know, I would suspect the wealthy Indian man would be a major accomplice, one of the most wanted men in the world at this point, is what I thought. And I gave my services to help identify and whatever assistance I could be. Well, a few days later, the FBI came to my law office, and I asked to see the airport security video because there's cameras all over the Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. And they refused. They actually kind of laughed about it. But being an attorney, I knew, well, that's what you do immediately. You have your eyewitness identify the person. Not only that, they didn't show me any still pictures of the helper in Amsterdam either, but they showed me about 8 other still pictures of other people. 2 of them were the underwear bomber himself. The other 6 I didn't recognize at all. But they kept, in my opinion, the purpose of the meeting was not to have me help them identify the accomplice, but to try and confuse me and make me think I didn't see what I did. So that started to draw red flags up with me. And then there were reports that came out shortly thereafter. Oh, we've watched 400-some hours of security camera footage from Schiphol Airport, and it shows no accomplice. Well, I knew that was a lie. So red flags are really going up with me at this point. And I started conducting my own investigation, talking to other passengers, reading everything on this story, going to all the court hearings, which were only about a 20-minute drive from my house. So I live close to the court, thankfully. And a lot of times I would be the only passenger from the plane at the hearings. And I would find that what the media would report from the hearings would not be what I would consider the important things that took place at the hearings. They would sensationalize minor things and not report on major things, like how the prosecution withheld a copy of his so-called passport until just before the trial, so his standby attorney couldn't hire experts to analyze it and that sort of thing. About a month after the event, there were hearings in Congress in the U.S. about the underwear bomber case, and it shocked me during the hearings when a State Department official, Patrick Kennedy, admitted that they knew the underwear bomber was a potential terrorist, but they put him on the plane intentionally. They admitted this, and you can watch it on YouTube, the video of the hearing. But they lied about the reason. The reason that was given by the State Department was to let him lead the government to other terrorists within the U.S. Sounds plausible, but after about a year and a half of my investigation, I figured out finally what had really happened. And what my investigation led me to discover was that the underwear bomber was given a defective bomb that lacked a detonator by a U.S. government undercover agent who the underwear bomber thought was a member of Al-Qaeda. So, interestingly enough, 2 expert witnesses hired by the prosecution to testify at the trial, bomb experts, were both going to testify that the bomb was impossibly defective. So I'm not even sure we can call it a bomb. But there was an article in the Detroit Free Press that said this. It's subsequently been scrubbed from online, but maybe you can find an archived version somewhere. So point being, Al-Qaeda does not go through this big setup to do this big attack and not have a bomb that would have a bomb that would be impossibly defective. So, you know, that with many, many other things I discovered throughout my research led me to believe that this was, in fact, a false flag attack. You know, and the government admitting they put him on the plane on purpose, and you can put 2 and 2 together. Then when I was going to testify at the hearing, the underwear bomber listed me as his only witness in the trial. But 3 hours into the trial, he pled guilty to mandatory life in prison with no chance of parole, which nobody ever does. You take your chances in a trial, you know, that maybe you'll win. Why would you take a plea to never getting out of prison? What made this extra strange was I had talked to a standby attorney many times as the court case proceeded, and we would often have conversations about how lenient plea deals were on the table because the government merely wanted the case to go away. Those were words from a standby attorney to me. So to reject lenient pleas only to take one to life in prison with no chance of parole does not make any sense whatsoever. A few months after the plea, I ran into his standby attorney at court on another case, and we had a discussion in the hallway about how ridiculous the plea was, and his standby attorney told me, well, that plea was made because the Arbor Bomber was either threatened or tortured while he was in prison. You can see how all this kind of played out. A lot of these things not reported or scantily reported by the media. I finally got 5 minutes in court to speak. You can read my victim impact statement online where I lay out a lot of what I consider to be the atrocities of this case to perpetuate a fraud on the American public. But that's basically the very, very short version of what happened to me and how I discovered and basically exposed the false flag underwear bomber attack single-handedly. I was really the only one in doing any investigation into this. So, you know, because of that, I know the playbook of the false flag attacks. I know the tricks because I was watching this one play out before me when I knew certain facts that I witnessed, and I knew certain other confidential information that I knew talking to his standby attorney and other witnesses, and I saw firsthand how the government and media would hide things, push other things, lie about certain things, hide other things, and I learned their playbook. So now I feel I can apply their playbook to other events that happen and realize which ones are factual and which ones are not.
Well, that's Kurt Haskell there, American lawyer, who was on the same plane as Umar Farouk Amulmutalab. I think I pronounced that right. That was the underpants bomber. That was in Christmas Day 2009. Martin, pretty interesting, but I mean, what he's saying there is everybody now, really, including himself, has got to look at every one of these attacks and assess it for themselves because you can't trust the press.
You can't, and you can't trust whether the government's statements about it when it happens. I'm not saying that all attacks are carried out by underground networks based inside the security forces, but it's a perfectly good working hypothesis for most of these attacks. They all fit the same pattern.
Okay, we've also had the death of King Fahd of Saudi Arabia this week. Now, the Saudi Arabia was set up back in 1915 by the British, wasn't it? The Treaty of Darin. Mm.
Indeed it was, and of course it's not I'm looking forward to the election, and if they don't have an election, I'm sure we'll be invading them soon, won't we?
Absolutely. Finally, Greece. We've got an election this week. Syriza coming in. What's going to happen there?
Well,
are they going to be in and out or out of the euro?
Well, they will try. If they win, they're going to come under an awful lot of pressure to kiss the boot. It'll be interesting to see how they react to that.
It certainly will. Okay. We're online at www.thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Don't let the banksters get you down, and we'll see you again at 5 next week.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, broadcasters say they'll go ahead with TV leaders' debates even if some parties refuse to take part. Channels have come up with a new proposal of 3 debates ahead of the general election. 2 of them will include 7 parties, one of which will be the Greens, which David Cameron previously hinted was a necessary inclusion if he was going to participate. There's been a huge rise in the number of people arrested in the UK on suspicion of Syria-related terror offences. 165 people were detained in 2014, compared to just 25 the year before. Our Home Affairs correspondent Mark White says the overall number of terror-related arrests was up too.
Last year it was at 327. That in itself was a 32% increase on the year before, and much of that I think probably down to the Syria effect.
A&E waiting times in England have improved for the second week in a row, but they're still missing national targets. NHS England wants 95% of patients seen within 4 hours of arrival, but that figure hasn't been reached for 3 months. Talks aimed at stopping next week's strike by NHS workers in England and Northern Ireland are still deadlocked. Union bosses say the walkout, which is over pay, could still go ahead next Thursday, despite 3 days of talks with health officials. If the strike does happen, GP Dr. Seema Jani says health centres will be under pressure.
My concern is that we're not paramedics, we're GPs. We're used to being in the community, not emergency care. It's a long time since any of us have had to deliver that sort of service in hospitals. And the other question it begs is, who's going to do my job when I'm not here?
Tributes are being paid to King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, whose funeral has taken place following his death at the age of 90. David Cameron and Prince Charles are flying out to pay their respects in person tomorrow. And Jason Donovan says he won't be returning to Neighbours. It was rumoured the actor would feature as part of the soap's 30th anniversary celebrations alongside Kylie Minogue. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Punch Touring presents the third annual Soul Acoustic Tour, celebrating the best in live soul music across the UK. On Tuesday the 10th of March at the Snug Bar in Bristol, featuring the Queen of Lovers Rock, Carol Thompson, Koth, Raheem Bakari, Dion Reed, Eva Lazarus, Silverstone and Stephanie McCourt. For more information, jump online.
punch-records.co.uk.
The third annual Soul Acoustic Tour, coming this March.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.